When chefs talk about the finest cuisines of the world, the United States doesn't really come up. Chef Dan Barber is trying to create a new American cuisine, one that could transform the future of food. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with Dan Barber, the best-selling author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. We'll talk about where he thinks the local foods movement has fallen short and what he believes can be done to make the way we eat healthier and more delicious. Later in the hour, documentary filmmaker John Heldy followed an Iowa farm through four growing seasons for his new film, Fieldwork, A Family Farm. I'll talk with him. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The local foods movement is gaining strength. Farmers, grocers, and chefs are all trying to meet demand for high-quality, locally sourced ingredients. But Chef Dan Barber thinks that the movement is missing a very important element, sustainability. Dan Barber is the executive chef at Blue Hill in Manhattan and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, a restaurant located within a nonprofit farm. He's also the author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. He'll be speaking tonight in the sunroom of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University at 7 p.m. Dan, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, I know that you have sort of been involved in the advent of the farm-to-table movement. That is a movement that has really gained strength over the years. It wasn't really your original intent to be a part of that movement, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't open up my restaurant with the intent of evangelizing for the movement, although Blue Hill, my restaurant, is named after my family farm in the Berkshires. And so the Berkshires is Western Massachusetts, and it's now a dairy farm. But I grew up grazing cattle for beef at the farm. And so I was hoping that the restaurant would be a source of of broadcasting, I guess, a message about the Hudson Valley and about local agriculture, but I didn't see it as our only defining message, and it's turned out to be actually.
So tell me a little bit about Blue Hill at Stone Barns, because this is a very unusual restaurant setup, but we actually have a similar restaurant at the Henry Wallace Center here in Iowa in Orient. But tell us a little bit about how Blue Hill at Stone Barns operates.
Blue Hill at Stone Barns is a nonprofit education center that houses Blue Hill at Stone Barns, my restaurant, which is a restaurant that utilizes everything from the farm. And so our menu is based on and revolves around the 20 acres of pasture and the 10 or so acres of cultivated vegetables and a little bit of fruit. And the goal of the restaurant is to showcase what's possible from intensive agriculture on a small scale.
And your journey to use these local ingredients and to come up with amazing flavors, which of course is your job as a chef, I mean, that has really resulted in you having a kind of intensive education on that farm that maybe was not your original intention.
Yeah, no, I've been schooled for sure, and I continue to be schooled on the realities of growing food for great flavor and great nutrition and you know, what kind of constraints that puts on me as a chef and what kind of pleasures I am able to derive from a great set of farming principles and practices that surround me.
Now, you have had many experiences because you're on the farm that have informed your worldview and your ideas. But in your introduction to your book, you write about an event where you were serving lamb chops at the restaurant that really made you look at the restaurant menu in a different way. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we opened the restaurant with the intent of doing sort of a traditional a la carte dining experience, where you order an appetizer and then you order a main plate, an entree. You know, that's significantly larger and also more expensive is how most restaurants are set up today. And what I realized in the throes of like a busy dinner service was that one of the entrees, these lamb chops, had been coming from lambs that the farm had grown for us, sold out in 10 minutes. And yet we were buying the whole animal because the farm was raising the whole animal. And so we were left with the rest of the sort of the carcass or whatever to sell on a later date because the menu had been printed. And so I started to realize that the logic of the architecture of the plate was all wrong. It didn't fit with the realities of utilizing, in this case, the nose to tail of the animal. And so I've changed the architecture of a lot of my plates to both better facilitate the use of the whole animal and also to better reflect what the land can really provide. And that means my plates of food do not now come with hulking, 8 or 10 ounce portion of a center cut like lamb chops. In fact, we serve a lot of grains and vegetables. We do serve a lot of meat, but we serve it scattered or in less dominating ways. So, for example, on tonight's menu, I have what we're calling a parsnip steak. So a parsnip steak is a steak is literally a parsnip that's been in the ground since last March. So it's been in, we call it soil age for 12 months. It's been in the ground since last March, and now that the soils are unfreezing and we're able to get in there and get them, we're excavating these enormously large parsnips that are super sweet because they've been going through the shock of the freezes during the course of the winter. So all the starches have really gone to sugars, and you have this incredibly tasty, sweet parsnip that we roast like a steak, and we roll it out to the dining room on a cart, and we slice it tableside, and we serve it with cream spinach and all the traditional accompaniments of a steak. We also serve it with a marmalade of brisket of beef, so that would be a cut of beef that's super delicious but rich, and we serve it as a garnish to the parsnip steak. So that for the amount of animals that we have grazing right now on our pastures, and for what we have slaughtering at this time of year, that's the right proportion for our that's the true sustain. That is a plate of food that's truly sustainable for this moment, and truly a reflection of what the farm can provide. And from my understanding of my relationship with the farm and perhaps my thoughts about the future of this kind of movement as we grapple with how to make the farm-to-table movement more popular and more sustainable and more delicious as we move into the future, we've got to figure out how to create these kinds of relationships on the plate and really a new kind of architecture that is reflective and celebrates a sense of place. And right now, the sense of place that we're celebrating is the end of the cold season and what that did to our root vegetables. In the case of parsnips, it dramatically improved them, and we want to show it off. And we do it in the context of sort of a clever sort of, clever in the sense that it's a connecting to the typical steak dinner. And so we can sell the idea because it's very iconic, and it everyone loves a steak dinner, but this is turning the steak dinner a little bit on its head because it's allowing us to celebrate and enjoy the parsnip at the moment of its finest creation or finest harvest. So So that's my take on the future of this movement, as we need to look at the farm-to-table idea and just go further and not cherry-pick ingredients like I was doing with that. You know, I was cherry-picking the rack of lamb that you mentioned before, because it's a coveted piece of part of the lamb. But if you're really going to work within the constraints of dealing with whole animals, or in the case of the parsnips or the grains that we grow, the entirety of the farm, not just nose to tail of the animal, but nose to tail of the vegetable and of the grain, of the entire ecology that makes up the farm, we've got to think in a different way for our diets.
And you've given us this beautiful contrast between that lamb chop meal and between the parsnip steak. And that is the contrast that is summed up in the title of your book, The Third Plate. So just so we fully understand this metaphor, start with the first plate that you're talking about. What is the first plate?
Well, the first plate would be sort of like those lamb chops. I mean, that's kind of the first plate mentality. Now, you know, it could be a steak dinner, too. I mean, it's basically what Americans... And I'm singling out Americans because they are both the greatest practitioners and abusers of this idea. But it would be a center cut of protein that we eat, you know, twice a day, 7 days a week. It's what we expect for a plate of food. And it's always protein-centric, and it always has a little bit of vegetable and grain sort of shoved off to the side. So the lamb chop in some ways is proportionally speaking, is you know, the first plate. But my lamb chops, the one that you referred to in the opening of my book, was really from grass-fed lamb from the farm. So that's farm to table. I mean, here I was, celebrating what the land produced and cooking these beautiful lamb chops. And we, the vegetables that were on the plate, were very much second plate vegetables. They were organic or then they were local. They were from the farm. And we did have some whole grains on the plate. So when you look at that in terms of the first plate, in terms of the typical American diet, it's definitely better. I mean, the lamb was raised in the right way. The vegetables are organic and local, and the grains are whole grains and better for you and all better tasting. So it's a much better plate of food, the one that I was serving when we opened the restaurant. But the one I'm more drawn to is the example I gave you with the parsnip steak, and you're right, I'm sort of defining that as the third plate because and there is no one definition. And in this case, it's throwing the steak dinner on its head and looking at a different architecture. But that third plate could look very different depending on where you're farming. I mean, it could look different. It will look different in Texas and in North Dakota and in Southern California and Oregon. I mean, it also depends on the time of year. So really, it's a plate that's continually and sort of in a celebratory way constantly in flux, and that's what we want from our diets, and that's what we get in all the, when we look at all the great cuisines of the world, that's what we see, is that we see great diversity, and we see it very much in a localized context and very seasonal, because that's what peasant agriculture, that's what cuisines came from. They came from peasant agriculture, and peasant agriculture
relied on
that.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll get back. We'll talk more about world cuisines and contrast them with American cuisine, our American diet, in just a moment. I'm talking with Dan Barber. He is the executive chef of Blue Hill in Manhattan and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, a restaurant located within a nonprofit farm. He'll be speaking tonight at the Sunroom of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University at 7 p.m. He's also the author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Chef Dan Barber. He is the executive chef at Blue Hill in Manhattan and Blue Hill at Stone Barns. He's also the author of the book The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. He'll be speaking tonight at Iowa State University in the Sunroom of the Memorial Union at 7 p.m. And Dan, just before the break, we were talking about those three plates that are involved in your metaphor, the third plate. And the third plate is local. It's sustainable. It doesn't necessarily revolve around a large cut of meat on the food or on the plate. And you were starting to talk about other cuisines of the world, when you look at the American diet and how it has evolved over time compared to these other cuisines that have also evolved over time, you see a very stark difference. What do you see?
Well, you're right. I mean, I think the third plate is, as much as I would like to claim it's a new idea and a provocative one for the future, actually a very old idea. It's reinterpreted for the American landscape, but really it's about looking at what the basis of all cuisines represents. And the basis of all the great cuisines of the world, the ones that we love to celebrate and eat often, like French food and Italian food and Chinese Cantonese food and Japanese food and all the thousands of others that are local interpretations of those styles. I mean, they all came out of this negotiation that peasants made with the landscape, and the negotiation was to figure out what the land could grow and then how could you make it both delicious and nutritious. And that took thousands of years, and patterns developed that supported the healthy landscape and that supported the reality of what farming could give you before you had chemical interventions and before you had, you know, modernization of farming. You had this kind of agrarian wisdom. And in many cases, it didn't work well for generations. But the great story of the cuisines that lasted and made it and the cultures that helped support those cuisines is that they were reflective of a local landscape, and that your patterns of eating, one's diets, were there to not only eke out what the, you know, eat support what the land could produce, but also to improve the landscape. I mean, look, I give you off, you know, the cuff is sort of like you think of Japanese cooking Japanese food as rice based, and you're right, except that you know, to get the rice, you needed to plant buckwheat as a rotation crop, because buckwheat into rice is a great rotation crop. It breaks up disease cycles and produces, you know, supplies the kind of carbon and soil structure that's needed to grow abundant yields of rice. So what did the Japanese do with the buckwheat? Well, they didn't do what we do when our farmers grow buckwheat, which is to throw it into animal feed, or to throw it into dog food, actually. You know, what they did is created soba noodles out of the buckwheat, right? And inculcated, you know, the tradition of eating buckwheat through soba noodles, and that's what it meant to be Japanese. You ate rice, but you also ate your soba, and the two of them corresponded to produce abundant agriculture and delicious agriculture and, you know, delicious gastronomy that supported that agriculture. I think that's the trick for the future, and that's what I'm calling the third plate: is how do we do more of that? And you know, my answer is really to look at our individual regions. We forget that America is just enormous, and that if there's, you know, a thousand interpretations of risotto in southern Italy, depending on which town you're in, you know, Italy sits inside of California. We ought to be thinking of thousands of different cuisines or patterns of eating that support local landscapes in the United States. And that, I think, is the future of good eating.
Is it also our past? I mean, people from all of these other cultures came to the United States and farmed here, and life was not easy here for a very long time. If you look into the past of the Midwest or the South or the, you know, the Southwest, do you see those patterns as well?
What I see in the overall history in my research, it's not to disagree with you, it's just to give a perspective that I was surprised to discover, which is overall our country has been, our country's agricultural history from the moment we got here has been one of abundance. Yes, there's been pockets of incredible destruction and low harvests and hunger and the rest, but overall we've been amazingly productive agricultural history. We're a fertile nation to begin with. We're a young country, so as impressive as our harvests have been, they've also been somewhat understandable in the sense that we have this amazing soil, and we have virgin soil because we're such a young country. You know, Europe and Asian civilizations just were never faced with what we are faced with, which is virgin land, rainfall, and temperate climates. And so we produce a ton of food, and we always have. And what I was struck by was the diary entries of Europeans who came to visit America and just were disgusted with the amount of food and the gross portion sizes and the waste that they discovered here on visits. And a lot of that was just that we were producing so much food, we didn't know what to do with it. And so you're right, people from other countries that were based on a cuisine ethic and a pattern of eating that supported landscapes just were not forced into that same negotiation here because they didn't need to be. And so, you know, part of our dietary issues today and our overconsumption and the wastefulness of this country's food culture stems from just that. We were just incredibly productive agriculturally, and we still are. And so it gets a bit complicated to deal with the kinds of issues that I'm talking about when you produce so much food because you're not forced into that kind of soba making gastronomic solutions because you don't need it. But increasingly we do, and increasingly we're seeing some very difficult times on the ecological horizon is becoming more fraught. Our resources, our environmental resources, are becoming either more expensive or disappearing, like water in California, for instance. And what we need to figure out is how to create a diet that's really inculcated into the everyday food culture that is more reflective of what our landscape can produce, not now or for 10 years from now, but over the course of several generations.
And even when we talk about the local foods movement, which has a strong relationship with sustainable agriculture or the idea of a sustainable agriculture, you see that in many ways we're just following the same pattern, that yes, we want these amazing flavors that can come from locally grown foods, but we're not looking at the whole picture. I mean, you have right. been quoted as talking about our love of tomatoes, for example, that tomatoes are what you call the Humvees of the farm.
Yeah, well, Hummers. Yeah. They you know, what we're taught and what look taught. This is what I have been, you know, waving the flag for a long time, which is like, you know, we need to buy tomatoes and zucchinis from local farmers and eggplants and you know, all these sort of cream crops. And they are cream crops because they end up requiring just a ton of soil fertility, a ton of real estate, and by the way, a ton of labor to have those become part of our dinner plate. Now, I do think a direct transaction with a farmer that's local and buying those and supporting them and eating more of them is great. But it's not the solution to an increasingly difficult problem. The solution is to vary the diet and to enjoy things like steak, lamb chops, and tomatoes and eggplant, but also to do what cuisines do so well, which is balance those very expensive, and when I say expensive, I mean environmentally expensive ingredients, with those things that end up producing the fertility that gives you those expensive things, like buckwheat, like you know, certain cover crops that we can actually be eating, like other lowly grains, like crops that, like radishes, that break up disease cycles. I mean, all of these. It's really about diversity. It's not about denying ourselves, but it's about being a little bit more selective than cherry picking what we just covet, which no culture in the history of the world has been able to do for very long.
I'm talking with Dan Barber. He's the author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. And you used tomatoes and eggplants there in the same sentence with lamb chops. I'm sure that there are a lot of people
who would take
some issue with that.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, but the more I learned about what a tomato requires from the soil and the amount of time it requires and the amount of real estate The analogy is actually right on. A grain-fed beef cow is certainly more expensive environmentally speaking, but we shouldn't forget that while we're told to eat our fruits and vegetables and more whole grains, we should be more Catholic in our desire to eat what the landscape best provides, and a tomato is again skimming the cream off the crop. So is wheat, by the way. I mean, we eat a ton of wheat in this country. We're Western civilization that, like everyone else, was founded on wheat, and the problem with wheat is that it too is an expensive crop from a soil perspective. But there's a ton of other lowly crops: rye, barley, buckwheat, millet. Leguminous crops, all the beans, fantastic beans, that are not part of the everyday food culture here, that could be really easily. We're not talking about giving up anything, by the way. I mean, I think this is really rooted in a lot of hedonism and deliciousness. And what we need to do is get to know these ingredients, these crops, and have them become part of our daily diet. And when they do, the economy for the farmer becomes much more interesting, because you can end up growing these cover crops and these disease-breaking crops and these carbon-injecting crops into the soil, and you can have an economy to do it. And that's really ultimately a democratization of the landscape and of the food, because we don't want to talk about the elitism. We don't want to move into a world where we're talking about elitism of buying these very expensive crops that few people could afford on a daily basis. What we really need to do is broaden that definition of what is sustainable. And I think that means listening to your particular landscape, and my landscape is very different from your landscape, and our landscape together is very different from what's happening in California. So it's going to take local knowledge and the nuts and bolts of what it takes to farm in that local area to determine what the proper percentage of these vegetable grains and meat should be on our plate.
You use the word elitism, and I wonder if that's one of the pitfalls that you see in the local foods movement, is that, and there are going to be people who would argue about this, but that if you're looking at buying local and you're looking at buying organic, there are a lot of people who are just priced out of that market.
Yeah, but that, and I wouldn't argue with people who make that argument. Because, I mean, I could argue again. I could say, look, we should be paying a little bit more for our food, and when it comes to our disposal income, we figured out ways to spend more money on a lot of things in the last 30 years, like cable TV and cell phones, and we've figured out ways to spend a lot of time on the internet in ways that have become indispensable to our daily lives because they become culturally very significant. Food could be that way too if we prioritize food, and in that case, we could probably, most of us could stand to spend a little bit more on food. There's a certain part of the population that can't, but for sure, a lot of us could spend a little bit more. Not every day, not twice a day, not three times a day for our meals, but once a week for sure. And that would make an enormous difference in our food culture and in our food chain. But to argue on to back up what you said before is I do think that farm to table cooking can really fall into the category of elitism because of the way it's practiced. It's cherry-picking ingredients that we most covet, and those tend to be very expensive. And farmers rarely bring to market the full farm. They rarely bring to market the what it really takes to grow those tomatoes. And that's a rotation of different vegetables and brassicas that either don't have a market or have a depressed market. And when they have a depressed market, you end up paying for all those crops, like the buckwheat, if you don't eat it. You end up paying for it in the rice. Well, we end up paying for those tomatoes, the zucchini and eggplant, in the fact that we don't pay for the entirety of the harvest. And that's what I think good eating is all about. So my hope is that farm-to-table of the future will incorporate a lot of these other lowly ingredients and get us to democratize the farm, because that's the ticket for true sustainability.
Do you see this as a movement that could catch on, or do you think it's going to take a crisis before this movement could catch on?
Yeah, I've had many people say, you know, that not ask that as a question, but just as a foregone conclusion that we've hit, you know, that it is really a very exciting social movement, and so there's this sort of idea that this is we're at the apex of a very exciting but ultimately a movement that is going to be on the downturn. Well, I don't see it that way. I mean, I see we're just beginning, because we're really rooted in pleasure here, and I think that if you're looking at this 10 years from now, you'll look back at this time and say, like, we're going to be, we're at the beginning of something. And because the reason I'm so gung-ho about this isn't because I have such a vested interest in it, although that might be part of it. The other part of it is just that we're rooted in pleasure. I mean, everything that I'm talking about in terms of what we should be eating more, all those grains that I mentioned, and then all of the vegetables that and the leguminous crops, and even the off cuts of meat that don't represent the lamb chop, but the offal parts, or the harder cuts of meat, like around the shanks, and the things that, you know, we talk about nose to tail eating of the animal. Well, ultimately, what we're really talking about is things that are super delicious, and so that's why I think the movement will continue in this direction, because it's based in hedonism, and that's one thing Americans are really good at is hedonism.
So this is the beginning of a new American cuisine.
I do. I think it is. I think it's going to take a lot of time, and it should, because cuisines take a lot of time to develop, and they take generations to bleed into the everyday food culture. But that's the goal, I think, and we shouldn't be thinking of this in the short term, but rather what our children's children will be eating.
Dan Barber, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Chef Dan Barber, he's the executive chef of Blue Hill in Manhattan and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, a restaurant located within a nonprofit farm. He's also the author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. He'll be speaking tonight in the sunroom of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University at 7 o'clock. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Ever since settlement first began in Iowa, agriculture has been the most important part of our economy. But farming has evolved over time and continues to change. The new documentary, Fieldwork, A Family Farm, premieres on Iowa Public Television this Sunday at 1 p.m. IPTV is an underwriter of Iowa Public Radio. The filmmaker behind the documentary, John Heldy, is here with me now. Hello, John.
Hi, Charity. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time. And now this documentary focuses primarily on one family farm, Charlie and Judy Swanson, their farm in Boone County. Can you describe the operation a little bit for us?
The Swanson's operation is mostly made up of rented land. They've been doing tenant work for a long time. They have about 550 acres, I believe. And most of it, like I said, is rented ground. And they farm mostly corn and soybeans, although they have started a commercial vegetable operation.
All right, and we'll talk more about that as time goes on. And they're making an effort to stay fairly small, right?
Yeah, that was what initially drew me to follow them through several years, was their conviction to stay family-sized farmers in an era when things are getting big all around them.
How did you connect with the Swansons? I mean, you're in Seattle, so what was the spark that drew you to them?
I was an urban guy. I grew up outside of D.C., and now I live in Seattle. But my family has owned 120 acres of Iowa farmland for over a century. My great-grandfather bought 120 acres in 1909, I think it was, and the Swanson family has actually been farming it since about 1930, I believe. My grandmother left Iowa probably, you know, in the mid-20th century, and so we didn't have any relatives there or any connection there, but I realized that we still had this farm in our family, and I wanted to see where that story led. And
oh,
I went out to Iowa to meet the Swansons, who were farming our land, and realized that they had this passionate conviction to stay family-sized.
That, so you have a strong family connection with that land as well. And I want to play just a moment from the film. This is, you didn't just follow the Swansons. You also talked to their family members, and you also met some other farmers in the area. But this is a moment where Charlie's dad and his uncle are sharing their memories of growing up on the farm.
That's all Dad ever farmed.
200 acres.
200 acres. We never hurt for something to eat.
No, we always had clothes to wear and something to eat. Just always wanted to be a farmer,
yeah.
I guess. I did nothing.
That's all I knew. I never went to college or anything.
I
never wanted to. I wouldn't have finished high school if it hadn't been for basketball. I really mean it.
You're who I got that idea from. Felt the same way. I could have had the GI Bill when I went came home from service. See, and I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to farm.
Well, that's the same here.
It was interesting listening to them talk about their experience growing up on a farm. Their dad never farmed more than 200 acres. That was enough for their family. And that was kind of a typical family farm experience in Iowa in the 40s. Farms grew and have continued to grow through time. But it really struck me listening to them talk about their memories that's also seems to be the kind of experience that Chuck and Judy want with their farm. They want to have a family farm that supports their family, and they're not looking for something bigger.
That's right. They really, what struck me when I went to meet them was they have this vision of all the family farming together. Their two sons want to come back into the operation. They want to farm, which is not typical these days. And they wanted to put together an extended family that would have enough acreage to make a living as a family, not grow into a huge operation that had to have employees, but just made enough that they could support themselves and maybe the two sons' families.
Now, how long did you spend following the Swansons through farming?
I started out in 2008, right about the time the Dow dropped 1,800 points in October, and that led to some interesting material during that time when prices fell and things changed quite a bit on the economic front. Originally, my vision was to follow them for 1 year through an entire growing season. But as I spent time with them, I realized I wanted to let that unfold on a longer timeline. So I ended up filming until 2011. I was glad I did because things changed in that time that I think really, really helped the story and that I was fascinated to see unfold for them.
Well, and it's so interesting, the uncertainty over a year in farming. And 2008 was a really tough year for a lot of farmers in Iowa because that was a year of major flooding. It was also, as you mentioned, a year of economic crisis. So there are a lot of stories to tell on the farm.
There are a lot of stories out there. And being, like I said, an urban guy, I just enjoyed spending time out there. I'm sort of an observational filmmaker by nature. I wanted to, in this film, spend time with farmers who are doing this, trying to stay family-sized, and just spend time following them through over time to kind of put the audience in their shoes to see, like, what are the challenges, what are the joys, what are the hardships that they face in trying to pursue that vision. There had been some good issues-based documentaries made, but I didn't feel, and those are strong films, I just didn't feel that they put you inside a farmer's life.
You connected with the Swansons at a really pivotal moment in their lives. As you mentioned, they wanted to continue farming with their two sons, and you connected with them at a moment where Jeremy, their older son, was really ready to be a farmer, and their younger son, Kylie, was still in school. at Iowa State University, but also hoping to farm in the future. And you sort of filmed over that transition as well. So you really picked the perfect moment to look at their lives. In talking with Jeremy, in talking about the future of farmers, what were some of the main issues that you encountered when looking at the idea of passing on this vocation to the next generation?
The thing that I heard time and time again is that most children of farmers are getting out of farming, or they're being told by their parents not to pursue it because it's too risky to do something safer. There's another farmer we spoke with, Craig Peterson, whose son has pursued a banking career, and he would like to come back and farm. But I could tell talking with Craig that he would love that on one hand, but he also feels like it's not something he wants to encourage. I felt like the Swansons were very interesting because they wanted to take that risk or find a way to take that risk. Because the two sons, Jeremy and Kylie, are passionate about farming. That's really all they want to do. One of the biggest challenges is money. How do you do that as a young person coming out of college? No young person right now can afford to buy land, to buy the equipment necessary. So the only way to get into it is to have a family and come in that way, using their equipment or using their land. And Jeremy does buy in the film. He buys some land, which is a very big move for a guy his age.
Right, he bought about 80 acres, an incredible investment, because, of course, we all know that at the same time as you were filming, I mean, Iowa land prices started reaching historic levels, and land in Iowa is still incredibly expensive. So there's this real scarcity that young people who want to go into farming encounter. And he talks about some really important factors. One, he bought this land, which was a huge investment. So he and his young wife, they have this incredibly big mortgage hanging out there. They also both have jobs off the farm. They don't know how they could farm without both having jobs off the farm. And he is farming using his father's equipment. That's the only way that he could make a go of the 80 acres that he bought. I mean, that's a pretty risky proposition.
That's right. You really have to piece it together in a patchwork way, and you end up having multiple jobs and taking risks, yeah.
You spoke to someone with Iowa State University Extension who shared some really interesting figures, and I had never heard it laid out in such a stark way. He pointed out that in 1988, there were 1,100 or 1,200 farmers in Boone County. By 2006, that was down to 800. And a lot of the farmers that you spoke to also talked about that, how people were not, young people were not coming back to farm, and farmers seemed to be getting older and older. What were some of the things that people were telling you about that?
Very much that we have an older population out in Iowa was what I heard over and over again. And, you know, who is going to fill those shoes when they move on? There aren't as many young farmers who want to continue. I think that's changing. However, I mean, I feel like in the time I was out there, one of the exciting things to see was what was happening in very, very small farms. We live in a time certainly where the big farms are still getting bigger on the very big end. There's some exciting things starting to happen at the very, very small, and even smaller than Swanson's. The Wilbers, who are in the film in Boone, have about 15-acre CSA operation. There are more, according to the latest census, there are more beginning farmers in 2012 over 2007. So maybe that tide is turning a little bit, and maybe there are different ways to farm.
Well, I found it very interesting that as you followed the Swansons through time, their younger son, Kylie, wanting to get back onto the farm. I mean, they'd always been a corn and soybean operation with a big kitchen garden that Judy has taken care of for years. She always felt that was kind of an insurance policy
right
for the family. But now, and let's play another clip from the film. This is about the transition that Kylie is making into farming, and it may be emblematic of a much bigger transition on the farm. Let's listen.
The tunnel is actually considered mine. Mom and Dad and I are going at this all together.
Through the tunnel, he is establishing himself as a farmer so that he will be qualified for beginning farmer status with benefits through the government. With the farm ground, the corn and the beans, or even a livestock, usually the parents would supply the capital and the child would supply the labor. And with the tunnel, it's actually kind of turned the other direction. Kylie supplied the capital to put up the tunnel, and we're supplying the labor to operate it at this point.
And the tunnel they're referring to is a high tunnel, so it's the operation that Kylie's getting involved in is a horticultural operation, growing tomatoes and other vegetables in the tunnel to extend the season. And so this very traditional farm is embracing what seems to be the new kind of farming. And of course, what's new is also old, but this new wave of farming in Iowa.
Yeah, that was a big change for the Swansons in 2011. And part of it, I think, stemmed from the high cost of land and the realization that, you know, it was not going to be easy to acquire more land to do conventional crops. One of the options that they started to see was available to them was growing vegetables commercially. And they set up this high tunnel, and Kylie was very much a part of that, putting it together and taking care of it, growing tomatoes, eggplants, cucumbers, all sorts of local vegetables that they sold to community entities around the state, just around the county.
Right, Boy Scout and Girl Scout camps and
exactly.
4-H camps, that kind of thing.
Nursing homes, yeah.
All right. And so one of the things that really struck me in the documentary, and Judy really put this into words in kind of a beautiful way. She talked about how she spent a lot of time growing up with her dad in the tractor, and that her kids spent a lot of time with her and her husband in the tractor. She says, I'd rather be in the tractor than anywhere else. But it really brings home this idea of farming and family being intertwined for her. Was that one of your takeaways, that really this attachment to family is also the attachment to the farm for the Swansons and for many others?
I was really intrigued to watch them work when they would all get together. This didn't happen all the time, but say at harvest or during planting, they would all be out in the field, and they obviously had been doing this for years, and they were a well-oiled machine, you might say. It was really kind of amazing to watch them work together as a family, and I do think that is, there's something beyond just the practical that is tied up in their desire to do that. Obviously, they want to farm as a family. They know how to work with each other. They enjoy working with each other, and they know that they can do it. They just love to do it. That was really clear.
What are you hoping people will take away from the film?
I hope that that people who farm and maybe our family farmers can see some hope for the family farm and understand that people depend on those farmers, and that kind of farm has a future. I hope that people who aren't farmers like me are able to sort of step into the shoes of a family farmer and understand what those challenges are and why it's hard and why people love to do it.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
John Heldy is the filmmaker behind the new documentary Fieldwork, A Family Farm. It premieres on Iowa Public Television on Sunday at 1 p.m. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime. Our address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.